Welcome back, Voltron fans, for part two of our exclusive coverage of Voltron: The Third Dimension. 26 episodes of Voltron in CGI animation that aired between 1998 and 2000. I am Mark Morell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast, and I'm really honored to be having this discussion with my two special guests, Shannon Weir and Gregory Tyler. In the last episode, part one, we had discussed some of the behind-the-scenes of Voltron: The Third Dimension and started reviewing each of the episodes. We'll continue talking about each episode and talk about the toys that were available when the show was on TV. Take us through again, if you will, Greg.
This next episode is called Dominus, and written by, I think I did mention, Bride of the Monster had been written by Sean Catherine Derrick, and Dominus written again by the writing team of Pamela Hickey and Dennis McCoy. This episode features a giant creature called Dominus that feeds off the energy of planets and utterly destroys them in the process. The Voltron Force finds out that Dominus is just a baby, little alien creature, a little baby that has been supersized by a spell from Hagar, and it's just trying to eat. And so the Voltron Force tries to get Dominus back home, but Lotor wants to use it as a Godzilla-like kind of a kaiju super robeast-like thing. And so that's the deal with this episode. Thoughts on this one?
Not all monsters are bad.
I like Dominus.
Yep, I like Dominus. That's the point.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah, and just like I liked Godzilla. I mean, it's similar to that. I did like Godzilla. I thought Godzilla was a good guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love the old Toho Godzilla films. But yeah, and one thing that I thought was really neat in this episode, I'm more of a general sci-fi fan than just a Voltron fan. And I really liked at the end of the episode when Dominus, who's been restored to his normal, sort of a house cat size, he's inside the cockpit of the Blue Lion and she's feeding him potato chips. She's got this little bag of chips open, sort of like a space food that a real-world astronaut might have, and except for all the crumbs floating around the cabin. But what's really neat is that the chips are floating from the bag into Dominus's mouth, which suggests that at least in that scene, the cockpit of the Lions exists in zero G, which I thought was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the next episode. This is one of my favorites: Voltron versus Dracotron. This is written by Scott Guy. This episode establishes a bit more backstory about Voltron. Hagar and Lotor summon five robot dragons, evil counterparts of the Lions, to fight the Voltron Force. Lotor attempts to basically assume control of these dragons, but fails. And the Lions come together and form this giant robot. These robot dragons form this enormous robot called Dracotron. The Voltron Force has to work together with Lotor to defeat Dracotron.
All right, I'd like to call him Dracotron.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Well, okay, the lead dragon was often called Draco or Draco, and then there's Dracotron. The pronunciations weren't consistent across the episodes, but, we could call it whatever we want to call it. Dracotron, how's that?
Right, well, the thing about this is my favorite episode of all of them, all right? And this is where I really learned what it means to be in Keith and Allura's head. All right, so here we have, Lotor trying to defeat the Voltron Force with Dracotron and loses control of it. And now he has to beg for help from the Voltron Force, basically. And then they have to come together to defeat Dracotron. So in my mind, at this moment where Hagar and Lotor are sort of held up in a cave or something, trying to hide from Dracotron, they have to ask for help from Allura and the team. And
Alora's response to this is, yes, we'll help you. And Lance can't believe it. And Keith is beside her, and he's like, yes, we have to help. And her basic thought is, we don't turn our backs to anybody, no matter what evil they've done.
Right.
So I thought that was a strong part of the show.
Yeah. Shannon, what are your thoughts?
I totally concur with this. It is an extremely strong episode to me. It also, that premise that you just stated about never turning back on anyone also echoes out of the original series when Merla, who really did reform, approaches them to try to help Lotor, and they actually have a debate on whether they should help him then. And here they are 5 years later, and Lotor himself has actually come to them for help, not obviously to reform, but just for help. And they kind of find themselves, okay, you know, do we stand by the same principles we stood by then? And that's a long time viewer's take, but I think it's core to the way that they look at things, and even new viewers understanding where they come from.
Yeah, and really, they even take it to the next level after Lotor's bacon has been saved, and Alora extends the hand of friendship to Lotor at the end. After it's all, after the crisis du jour has been resolved, she reaches out in an offer of friendship, and of course, Lotor rejects her and says, you know, only if you marry me, blah blah blah. Which, and of course, they go their different ways at that point. But so Alora continues to act as a force of peace and understanding, and reaching out to your enemies. And so even after the crisis is over, she reaches out, and I thought that was really a strong thing. Also, I wanted to touch again on the lore of Voltron. So this show establishes that there, you know, just as there were five lions, there were five dragons. Now, how they're connected, if they're connected, don't really know. But there's an implication here that, or actually stated outright, that the ancestors of Alora previously encountered these dragons and had to deal with them in some way. And when this episode, when we see these five dragons, each is I believe each is a different color. I don't think they exactly match up with the five lion colors, but the central dragon called Draco or Draco, whatever, it's black in color, and we see it in these enormous chains on this planet. And so it seems that folks from planet Eris in generations past have previously encountered and defeated these dragons. So it's kind of neat to have some suggestion of a history there.
Right. And it looked really cool.
Oh, yeah. we'll get into merchandise a bit later, but one of the items that Trendmasters had planned to release for the Voltron the Third Dimension toy line was a transformable combining Dracotron. I've seen photos of two different prototypes, one of them seemingly in color, the other one mostly chrome or whatever, but it really looks a lot like the Dracotron seen in the series. And some of the action figures and toys don't really look much like what you see on the show, but this one in particular seems to match up really closely, and I would love to have owned one of those. All right, so moving on, Descent into Madness, written by Kelly Ward. And let's see, Keith actually officially discovers that Zarkon is evil, but the lion, he crashes and he loses his grip on reality. A spell is cast on him by Hagar that renders Keith into something that they describe as a lion boy. He basically is in his little cell in the castle, growling and acting all cat-like. He eventually, of course, with the assistance of the spirit of Black Lion, regains his senses, but he forgets that he had discovered that Zarkon is truly evil. Thoughts on this one?
It's one of those things where it's like, okay, we let the viewers in on something, but our team ends up, you know, not being privy to stuff in the end, as I recall this. I'm actually more interested in what Mark has to say on it, to be honest.
That was sort of what I wanted to go along with here, is that, you know, this whole time, okay, we're all thinking the same thing the Voltron Force is thinking, you know, every episode up until now, I'm thinking, okay, when does Zarkon, you know, prove that he's evil? When does he, you know, this nefarious plan that he's got underneath all of this, you know, stuff where he's pretending to be good? It's got to happen, right? Because this just can't go on, because it's driving us crazy, all right? And then here we see, oh, yeah, There it is. All right. Oh, and Keith saw it. Great. Now we can really address this and we can move forward and go against this and all this. Wait. No, Keith. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Keith. Oh, great. Now nobody knows except us, the viewers.
Yeah.
Great. So it was frustrating, but at the same time, it took me through a ride. So I liked that.
Yeah. So what do you think about this Lion Boy thing?
I don't know. That was kind of strange.
Yeah, I mean, this to me, this would have been a perfect opportunity to sort of get into Keith's mind and maybe take something that was really in his mind and twist it, you know, and so maybe drive him into some weird state based on something that is the essence of his character, instead of just, oh, let's just make him run around and growl at people, you know. I mean, Keith, he's, you know, the leader character in a lot of these shows typically is the white bread. And I mean that just like in the sense that, you know, there's not a lot of nuance. You know, usually there's the Dudley Do-Right. And I use that with awareness that my Voltron screen name is Dudley Drew-Right. You know, he's the do-gooder with strong principles. And is usually there's usually a high risk of a character like that being very two-dimensional. And so I would really like to have seen them dive into his psyche a little bit, and as they sort of did with Hunk feeling inferior about being called stupid in the earlier episode, and Lance, of course, with his past, his world being attacked. I would like to have seen something that kind of gets into Keith's head a little bit. What are your thoughts on that?
This may have been a case where the animation and the animation cost of animation and everything may have kept them from doing what you had requested.
Oh, well,
probably.
That's a fair point.
Yeah. Additional sets, additional things like that, you know, that it does. Budget is always a consideration that you have to think of.
And it may have just been easier to make him into a Lion Boy.
Yeah, good call. All right, moving on. Pidge gets iced. This episode is the return of head writer Mark Handler as the writer of this episode. Pidge goes to a planet called Glacia to examine this new development called Thunder Ice, the coldest matter in the universe. He's assisted by a robot that Zarkon and Amalgamus assigned to him, a robot called Igor, also pronounced Igor in this episode. I don't know if that's a Young Frankenstein reference or what, but anyway, it turns out that Igor is actually a battle Borg that freezes Green Lion and tries to freeze Pidge. And so the Voltron Force comes to Pidge's rescue, and you know, Pidge has to find a way back into Green Lion so that they can fight back and get away. And at this point, let's see, Keith actually observes that Zarkon has altered one of Amalgamus's computer chips. So he's actually at the Galaxy Garrison and sees Zarkon tweaking Amalgamus's guts. And the Voltron Force at the end of this episode openly accuses Zarkon of planting Igor to turn on the robots at Pidge, and makes an argument that Amalgamus has been tampered. Amalgamus wins out and basically says that, you know, you don't have any evidence that meets the standards of the Alliance. I have to retract that. The Voltron Force does not openly accuse Amalgamus of being tampered in this episode. They simply accuse Zarkon of planting Igor at this point to turn on Pidge. So thoughts on this one?
I just remember Mark Handler saying that this was one of his favorite episodes to write when we talked to him, and that it had a lot of different elements in it, and one of those was the Voltron Force actually thinking that Zarkon was doing something evil.
Yeah.
So that's what I remember.
When Pidge and Igor go to Glacia, there's a staff of robots that are helping to harvest this thunder ice stuff, and the robots are a bunch of comic relief, just silly, blundering idiots that, of course, Igor dispatches. I kind of like the levity of that, of the robots being kind of silly. I don't think they took it to the ridiculous extreme that the battle droids in Star Wars Episode One had. You know, Roger, and all that garbage. But
yeah.
But I kind of like the levity here and there. I actually am one of the people who kind of likes the cheese in Voltron that creeps in sometimes, you know, like the space mice. I like the levity of that. I mean, You know, it would be easy if the show went full tilt with evil being really bad and everybody's after the Voltron Force and what are you going to do? I mean, you could get into a really dark place pretty quickly, and I think that moments of levity are welcome.
And even some snarkiness sometimes from the characters to each other, you know, that's always helpful.
Yeah, I think that as this show evolves, I really like the banter in particular between Keith and Lance. When they have their meeting of the minds, and over time as these shows progress, they become faster friends than maybe they were even in the original series. And when they have those moments where they sort of badger each other a little bit, it's really fun. I also remember liking some of the combat scenes in this episode. And in general, I will say we haven't really touched much on the feel or the visual dynamic of the show. But I really like a lot of the combat scenes involving the Lions. I think when you see them sailing around in space with that weird, bizarre Babylon 5 White Star engine sound effect as they're zipping around and all the crazy weapons and all that, I think that, you know, as the 3D cameras following them as they zip around in these valleys and all this stuff, I think that it really brings a sense of I think that it really adds some appeal, some visual appeal to the battles that you might not get in a show with a more two-dimensional background. You know, it's like a 2D sort of thing. When the camera follows the Lions as they're zipping around, there's a definite dynamic there that I really like.
I definitely liked it better when the Lions and the battles and stuff took place on planets where you could see, you know, backdrops of the landscape. But yes, when they're in space, only when it was like an explosion and something do I really like those parts. But they did have a lot of more space battles in this than they did have in the original series.
That's true. And it may be in part because it's just when you're in zero G, you don't have, or when you're flying, you don't have to animate four-legged creatures running around, you know? So this may be another budgetary sort of thing. I do wish we'd seen them on the ground more acting like lions instead of spaceships with legs, and tails. But I do think that some of the visual dynamics of the lion combat scenes are really appealing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dark Heart, written by Mark Young. This is an interesting episode. Hagar traps King Alfor's spirit inside of a crystal Robeast, and the Voltron Force has to engage this Robeast in battle. And so Allura learns a bit more about her past and has to try to free her father's spirit. So this is a different episode than a straight action show. What are your thoughts on this one?
I think this definitely comes down to an Allura versus her father kind of thing, where she would never go against her father, and thus the reason why she faces him unarmed when he's a Robeast. So I really think this comes down to the father-daughter relationship, and I think it was well done.
Shannon?
This one, in its first viewing, had an interesting pill to swallow for me because I had to look at what, again, coming from the old fan perspective, was there was nothing in the original show that indicated to us that Hagar and Alfor had once been an item.
Right. Yeah.
That is an element of this episode. And you're like, okay, they're both magic users. So how did he end up choosing Allura's mother? There were questions that got raised there. It's like, because we know she looked better at, you know, at one point in her life, and that's also obviously stressed in this episode.
Right.
But once you take that, you know, once you're able to accept that element of it, it is a beautiful episode. It is one of my favorites of the set, and it also sets the stage for the rest of the series arc with a major element introduction, which I don't know if you guys want to go into yet or not. So I won't reference.
I was referring to this one in our previous discussions with Mark Handler about how it had sort of like a Romeo and Juliet type of feeling with the Montagues and the Capulets and all that kind of stuff, where they were sort of forbidden from seeing each other.
Right.
And because he went along with that and she doesn't understand why, that's how she became as evil as she did.
Right. And it's also interesting. I remember Mark Handler acknowledging that this episode sort of contradicts the backstory for Hagar in the 80s Fleet of Doom two-parter, where you know, she was this beautiful whatever, and Zarkon corrupted her. And basically, the backstory for Hagar is different in this episode than it was then. I don't think they're entirely irreconcilable, but there are some differences there. Certainly, the Hagar Alfor thing had not been explored as Shannon stated. So, I like this episode a lot too. It's also fun that they in this episode, you know, Allura is alone for the first time with respect to her father. I mean, she at the beginning of the episode, she's at his monument and seeking guidance and all that. Well, when Alfor is taken, she's kind of alone, but she hears a voice. Or we hear reference to a guardian spirit voice. I'm sorry, she doesn't hear it, but Alfor tells Allura that he had heard when he fought the dragons, seemingly the Dracotron dragons, that he heard some kind of a spirit voice that guided him into chaining that dragon, the Black Draco, with only his will. And so this voice will certainly play into future episodes, as I believe Shannon just alluded to a bit ago. So it's kind of interesting that she's sort of, for the first time, at least for a short while, without the guidance of her father, but learns a little bit more, and she will that story point gets expanded on for her in later episodes. The next episode, the 13th in this sequence, so we're at the halfway point, is The Big Lie, written by Kelly Ward. Amalgamus proposes to the Voltron Force to the Galaxy Garrison High Council that the Voltron Force be disbanded. What basically happens in this episode is that Keith and Lance independently spy, or they go out independently, but they meet up and spy on Zarkon and hear very explicitly about his plans. They bring this information to the Galaxy Alliance, as well as the charge that Amalgamus has been tampered with by Zarkon, and as the counter to this, Amalgamus disbands. He not just proposes the disbandment of the team. He actually does disband them.
This clearly, in order to really bring this series where it needed to be on the whole, as we talked about earlier, there's a lot of arcs, a lot of things that have to be in sequence, and clearly this was an event that was being built up to. At the at the midway point of what turned out to be the entire series of 26, it is the logical point for its occurrence. The idea that everything coming to a head and seeing, we're so used to here's the Voltron Force and the pilots and all that going together, and as viewers, even newer viewers, there's been that belief to come to believe in them despite what's going on. And all of a sudden, it's like that ultimate bit of defeat. Like, what are we going to do now when the people who should be backing them don't have totally pulled off any belief in them? What happens next? And I think that was really a good place for this to go, because the whole thing, even on a vehicle Voltron perspective to this point, had always been the Alliance is always behind us. But what happens when they're not?
Right. I had a quick thought not long before we began our conversation about Amalgamus as a foil versus Sky Marshal Wade from Voltron Force. There is a bit of similarity in the two. I mean, if you think about just their very nature, Amalgamus is a machine who trusts machines over people. Sky Marshal Wade in Voltron Force has these mechanical robotic things that he uses as his foot soldiers, and he tries to duplicate Black Lion, or at least figure out how it works from a technological perspective. And both are actually in power when you would probably expect them not to be. I mean, Amalgamus is sort of just universally trusted as this authority figure by all 900 Alliance member worlds. And in Voltron Force, Sky Marshal Wade, through fear or manipulation or whatever, is in a similar role in that series. So I do think there's a bit of a similarity between the two. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I definitely agree with that. I'm wasn't sure whether we were going to bring Voltron Force into this or not, but there were a few aspects of Voltron Force that I had seen in some of these previous episodes. But in reference to this, can I talk about this episode a little bit?
Sure.
Oh, please please do.
Okay. All right. It seems to me that and what happened at the beginning of Voltron Force was just this, that the Voltron Force could get disbanded shouldn't even be a question. I mean, based on everything that had happened in the past There's no means of defense in any other way, in any other galaxy, that was as good as Voltron. Why would there ever be a question, should Voltron Force be disbanded? That just doesn't seem like that should ever even come up as a question in the Galaxy Alliance, when that was your number one defense against everything out there.
I would agree with that. I mean, certainly we know. I'm sorry, go ahead, Shannon.
I was going to say, though, yet this is the same structure that's somehow over time, or maybe passivity, gotten to the point where they're willing to have this not 100% human, since we've argued what Amalgamous is, in charge of them to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So what is their frame of mind that they even allow this? Are they to the point where it would be easy enough to corrupt them into the next step?
Yeah, right. That's a very good point. And it does make you wonder what in the world is going on with the people at large.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was my big thing here. Obviously, for the Voltron Force to be able to convince other people that Amalgamous had been tampered with, that's a hard thing to do. So if anybody could do it, Pidge could, though, right?
Yeah, hopefully.
You'd think.
Yeah.
You'd think.
Yep. So moving on then, the next episode is The Trial of Voltron, written by Pamela Hickey and Dennis McCoy. This is a clip episode. Kind of interesting in this 26-episode series that there are two clip episodes. This one basically has Amalgamous trying to argue that the Voltron Force should, in fact, be disbanded. The other, basically, to debate whether or not the Voltron Force should be allowed to go on. We're presented with a bunch of flashbacks from earlier episodes of the series, basically showing a bunch of adventures that they've gone on and you know, basically, it's the evidence that the Galaxy Alliance High Council will use in determining the fate of the Voltron Force.
Well, when it comes to the timing of this episode, it's originally listed as like the 25th, right?
Right.
I can see why this would be sort of towards the end. I mean, it comes down to the fact that you're showing all these flashbacks of what everything, all the good that Voltron Force has done. And I can see why you're putting that near the end of the series.
Well, that's why they put iTunes listed it as one of the last episodes. But yeah,
right.
Oh, that's where you guys are getting the numbers from. I don't think iTunes is using the numbers correctly.
Yes, and so
I think it's possibly production order numbers, since the two clip shows are at the end, and I believe that they knew in advance they were doing the whole sequence and then released part one and part two. It would be logical, having worked on shows, usually scripts are assigned numbers in the order that they are submitted. And that becomes their production number for budget reasons.
Right.
If they knew they were running out of money at the end, I don't know if this is a fact, but it's one way I would look at it. They're like, what do we do? Okay. Clip shows mean we have to render less new animation.
Right.
They may have been an afterthought, and then they went back to the arc. Has anybody actually ever asked Mark that question?
No. Sorry.
That's been my professional thought about them all these years. I'd love to
That's
know
very
answer.
Possible. And so, again, the sequence that we're walking through these is based on what I attempted to stitch together as a logical narrative sequence. And so, this sequence, it is a logical follow-on to The Big Lie, which by both iTunes and IMDb aired in late February of 99. And so to jump ahead by a year to February 2000, which is when iTunes claims this show aired, seems really wonky to me. But regardless, IMDb had this listed as airing in early May. So this may account for a hiatus between seasons. But in any case, from a narrative perspective, this seems like a logical place for it. But
But looking back on this now, it looks to me similar to like the last episode of Seinfeld, you know, where they're on trial and then all these people come back in that were on previous episodes that can tell of all the bad deeds that they had done.
Right.
But in this case, it's telling all the good deeds that Voltron had done. So.
Yeah. And I did like an OCD individual go back through the clips, and the clips are all from episodes the episodes that we have just gone through and none of the episodes that follow in this sequence. So, you know, it does fit, but yeah, I can see the I can see why it might evoke thoughts of Seinfeld.
And that's all I have to say about that.
Okay. Anything else, Shannon?
The biggest stuff that was significant on this, I actually spoke to in my introduction. This was the episode that I mentioned where they pulled heavily from my star map when Armistice is speaking.
That's
so
right.
So outside of that, I think you guys got it pretty right.
Yeah, I really liked, in speaking to that, I really liked when Judge Armistice, speaking for the quadrant that he represented, and I just don't remember the name, but when he lists various planets that have been helped by Voltron, he does specifically point out Ebb and Pollux, which were prominent in the 80s series, Ebb being where Sven was sent after he was injured by Hagar, and Pollux, of course, being a sister world of Eris, where Princess Romel and Prince Bandor were from. So that was really cool. Moving on, next episode is The Troika Moons, written by head writer Mark Handler. Lotor threatens to destroy the heavily populated Troika Moons unless the Voltron or the Galaxy Alliance destroys the robot lions. Lance quits the Voltron force, tries to steal Red Lion, but is incarcerated or he's captured by the Galaxy Alliance. Amazingly, at the end of this episode, the robot lions are destroyed. Thoughts on this one?
Wow.
Yeah, this was a big one.
Yeah. So what's very interesting to me, in addition to thinking, how in the heck could anyone allow this to happen? You know, whether it's Amalgamous, anyone else in the Galaxy Alliance, the pilots, and especially Princess Allura, how do you let this happen? It's the fact that it can happen. These lions are seemingly invulnerable. I mean, they've saved the universe's bacon on so many occasions, and yet these goofball tanks with the technobabble what's it's attached to them just basically slice them into nothingness as if they were made of butter. So you have the improbability of this event actually happening, and the improbability of this event actually happening, the how and the why. Wow. I will say that seeing them torn to bits is a shocking visual, whether you like it or not. It is a heck of a thing to see them cut to ribbons.
And here's the thing. I think this may have been the inspiration
that Alex Albrecht got
for Voltron, the End live-action short film. Have you seen that?
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, yeah.
So that Voltron, the End live-action short film, you know, sort of describes what would happen if the Voltron force failed, and it specifically showed Red Lion. So,
oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
good
I
call.
Thought this episode may have been the inspiration for that.
That could be. Huh. I'm also reminded a bit of, in terms of the shock value, there was an episode of, if you can call this show, this show is debatable in how good you think the stories are, but He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, there's an episode where He-Man thinks he has actually killed an opponent, and he relinquishes the power sword, and eventually has to get it back by the end, but it's one of those shocking moments. Wow, there is no more He-Man. Well, in this one, wow, there's no more Voltron. And yet, as the lions are completely destroyed, you see these colored orbs of energy, one for each lion, ascend into the heavens and sort of swirl around one another and then disappear. So even in this episode where the robots are these mechanical robot lions are rendered, you know, junk, you see that there may be something more to these lions, and off it goes into the heavens. So it almost seems like even though there's more than cogs and whatever else, even that seems to have been gone. And that's quite a shocking visual.
It was their souls.
Yes, yes. So moving on, Queen Ariella, written again by head writer Mark Handler. Ironically, Lance is now in Bastille 12 in the same cell that Lotor had occupied at the beginning of the series. He's there because he had tried to save Red Lion. And the Voltron Force, the remaining pilots, are out to try to get him, to retrieve him. And in the meantime, Lotor attacks Planet Eris. Allura learns more about the lions, and Amalgamous himself realizes that not only was destroying the lions a bad thing, but that Zarkon is a bad guy.
Well, this had to happen, all right, especially following that last one. It had to happen in order for some of these questions to be answered. So I'm glad that Mark was still in charge of this one, because it seemed to flow pretty well.
From my point of view, I mean, it made sense that just in the, as he had in the beginning, Lance was the first not to believe in what was going on. By the same token, Lance would be the first one to say, I want to do anything I can to prevent this. So that made total sense.
Right.
But by having him now in prison this time, it's also now it's sending a message that rebellion shall not be tolerated, at least from Lotor, you know, Amalgamus, that point of view. The key thing, and you've mentioned the title when you read it, was Queen Ariella.
Yes.
Who only starts to get mentioned in this one. The huge changes is in the mythos. And again, I'm going to take this from the female fan perspective. The idea that this is the first time we've seen a new positive, well, any actually female component introduced in the mythos. Because we had Allura and Hagar originally, and then Merla got added in that. I mean, Ramel's secondary, but those were top three out of the original.
Right.
Ariella's status for the remainder of this arc, even though she's a deceased like Alphor is, puts her on a very important status.
Yes. Yes. And so very quickly, this episode really deepens the mythical background of Voltron. And so before I jump into that very quickly, it's also worth mentioning that by this narrative sequence that I stitched together, Alphor no longer appears in the series. They never really say that he's gone. But following that episode where his spirit was actually freed from that crystal robe beast, he never shows up again. And so it's very interesting that he sort of, without being stated, he sort of passes the torch of, guardian angel, so to speak, onto Ariella.
Allura had probably learned the last of the key mysteries she needed to learn about the lions.
That could be.
And Alphor was no longer needed.
That's true. I'm actually reminded of, you had spoken of the Star Wars novelizations and all that stuff, the Timothy Zahn Star Wars trilogy where Obi-Wan Kenobi finally leaves Luke to his own devices. You know, the ghost of Obi-Wan says, you know, you've learned all you can from me, I've got to go, and he leaves Luke on his own. This is sort of kind of similar to that. Very quickly, I know I don't want to, you know, keep us going on forever about the episodes here, but quick backstory about Ariella. According to this episode, she was on a spacecraft as an infant, and her ship was somehow forced down under fire and crashed on planet Eris. She was the only survivor of the people on that ship, and she was an infant. She was actually raised by lions, a green lion, a yellow lion, a red, a blue, and a black lion. They are organic, you know, normally sized Earth-type lions. They actually look like lionesses. They don't have manes, which is also interesting. They may be female. The lions raised her somehow. The lions are shown to be able to fly in this episode. They established that it was Ariella 1,000 years ago, again, who built the Castle of Lions and dedicated it to those lions. The lions pledged to protect the castle and the royal line of Eris. Ariella brings about the appearance of the five lion spirits to Allura and everyone. So her ghostly form helps to bring them about and show them and expose them as ghostly images, much like Obi-Wan Kenobi from Star Wars, to the pilots of the Voltron Force. So there's a whole lot of backstory that gets put on us here. And I think it really is sort of mind-expanding in the sense of what Voltron might be and the history of Eris and how it might tie in. What are your thoughts on the mythological angle of this episode?
In the end, I really liked it. I felt it was very well thought out. It definitely explained a big question I had had since the original series, which was, why is it that the royal line of Eris seems to be the only people with powers? Well, if the queen came from another planet, that explains a heck of a lot of things.
Right.
Because she's not of that world, and that's why only Alphor and Allura and so-and-so, and why we don't ever see it among anybody else ever interacted with.
Right.
And it brings up the question of, okay, these are robot lions, and there's this mythological thing going on, and there's magic that forms Voltron and everything, and we talk about the original Voltron being one sentient being. Where does the whole idea of lions come from in the first place?
Well, this certainly tries to explain that. So, yeah, I mean...
Yes.
What's interesting about this episode, in addition to all that we've just discussed, is that this seems to be the only episode in any Voltron show, either Defender of the Universe or the Third Dimension or even Voltron Force, that features neither the robot lions nor Voltron. So, I mean,
yeah.
They're mentioned in passing, so you see them as backstory elements in the early episodes of Defender of the Universe. But in this one, there are no robot lions. There is no Voltron. They don't physically exist now. You have the spirits, but there's no. I mean, they're rubble at this point. So that's very interesting.
True.
Mm-hmm.
So moving on, the Voltron Force strikes back. Again, written by Mark Handler. Allura officially learns in this episode that the robot lions have the spirit of those real lions from Eris. And that those spirits have been sworn to protect Eris. So they call on this, the Voltron Force calls on the spirits of the lions, and the lions are returned. They are restored to physical form. They form Voltron. They fight Lotor.
The impetus here is the team coming together for something they believe in, and there's this disbelief that you might have that this could possibly be real, that the spirit of lions is something that they could actually, you know, come together to bring back or something like that. You know, there's a lot of spirituality in this, and I'm not sure that, you know, all these guys are had bought into that originally, but I think they're fully into it now.
Yeah. I agree.
My one comment about the episode that's a bit implausible is that the lions just poof, we're back. The robot lions, I mean. You know, they're very tough. They're tough in combat. We saw them completely obliterated, but now they've just sort of returned simply because the spirits of the lions have been called upon. And so, you know, where did they come from? Were the robot lions just sort of formed in the sky when above them, and they, you know, they just kind of descended from the clouds somehow? Did they emerge from machinery that was reanimated in the lairs of the lions? What in the world happened? Really not answered. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it might add to the mystery of, you know, where do these lions come from to begin with? How were they originally turned from Voltron parts, you know, the five parts of Voltron that Hagar created when she tore them apart into the lions to begin with. So it's left unexplained. Maybe it's an implausibility. Maybe it just adds to the mystery.
I think it adds to the mystery.
Agree.
Yeah, agreed. Moving on, Raid on Galaxy Garrison, again written by Mark Handler. The Voltron Force regains, they get custody of Amalgamus, they rescue him, and they repair him. In this episode, the story point is that he is now very supportive of the Voltron Force, and he's also pretty formidable in combat, which is really cool. So what are your thoughts on this one?
I have one word, finally.
Yes.
Yes.
All right, I had been waiting for this for the longest time. I'm like, oh, would you guys finally get in there and just get him fixed up and everything, and now he's finally where he should be.
Yes.
And it just took too long to get there, in my opinion.
I agree. I totally agree. I do think that, you know, ignoring that finally thing, I did love seeing how effective he was at controlling combat machinery remotely and all that. I thought that was neat that they acknowledged that as this robot that's not just clued into the 900 Alliance members somehow, or Alliance leaders somehow, he is also clued in and keyed into, networked to the various defense systems, which was really cool. So that was kind of neat, him showing that he, as a robot, can actually do something cool. Moving on, Mind Games, written by Kelly Ward. In this episode, the Voltron Force learns to use telepathy to control their lions. Pidge has difficulty with this. He gets captured. He's freed, and he does learn indeed how to master telepathic control of his lion.
Is this actually, if you tie into what I was just saying a little bit earlier, here's the step, though, where, okay, here are people outside of the royal line of Eris that are being taught to tap in. But if we also look at what was said before, much earlier, how it seemed like only certain people could be attuned, I'm like, that was like, okay, I can go with this. It made sense. I mean, if there's this whole play on the souls are serving, but there only seem to be right types of human souls that can interface, it was a logical next step to go now that they know that there are sentient spirits in the lions themselves.
I do wish they'd followed up on this a bit more. It's you know, they now that they can control them telepathically, it would have been neat to have seen them do that beyond this episode. Yeah. But this is one of those deals where, you know, they gain this new capability and then forget it. I'm reminded a bit of Knight Rider, where, you know, in the middle seasons, Kit got some new upgrade of the week and it was used in that episode and then forgotten in the future. You know, I would like to have seen that done a bit more here, but there were only a half dozen episodes, or roughly a half dozen episodes after this anyway. And they had to pimp a new kind of Voltron, which we'll touch on here shortly. But I do think it was a logical story progression.
I just wanted to say, for Pidge to be the one that wasn't any good at it, all right, it kind of makes sense. I mean, he's very science-oriented, logic-oriented. Plus, he's actually a boy man, sort of, you know?
Yeah.
He may not have fully matured in the way to be able to handle mental telepathy. But... he may have resisted based on just being a scientific geek.
Yeah, and I also like that he established that even among his own people on Balto, he's a bit of a runt when it comes to telepathic development. He says that even among the people in his world, that's an area, that's a skill or ability that he has not yet mastered. So it's kind of neat that, you know, in Voltron Force, again, I'm not trying to bring the other show in too much, but he's this techno ninja DJ. You know, he's just all around cool and awesome and wears nifty green glasses. In this show, it's cool. I mean, he's super smart and all, but it seems that even among his own people on Balto, he might be a bit of an outcast in a negative way. And that was kind of neat that he brought that to the table in this episode.
Yep.
Moving on, Castle Doom, Dead Ahead, written by Kelly Ward. Hagar has set a trap for the Voltron Force. They're trapped in a replica of Castle Doom. An illusory sort of thing. It's basically a haunted house that preys on the fears of the Voltron Force. Thoughts on this one?
All right, I'm going to harken back to the original series, because not too long ago we had reviewed an episode from the original series that was just like this.
Yeah.
Except there were some kids that were like explorers looking for, you know, treasure and stuff like that. And the Voltron Force... went with these kids into the house or the castle, and it was a haunted house, and it was preying on their fears and everything. It just seems like a reboot of that from the original series. Plus, this really doesn't fit into everything that happens here, and that whole episode could have just been taken out of this, and we wouldn't have missed it.
Right. I will say that I had, when I was stitching together a narrative sequence, I had trouble placing this one because it is so standalone. It doesn't fit in. It doesn't fit better or worse anywhere in the sequence. I believe I put this in simply because it seemed to coincidentally air in a certain sequence around other episodes. But yeah, it's very much a standalone. I will say that this episode had a very shocking visual, which was... Lance is encountering this illusion of Lotor mocking him, or I think it was Lotor, it might have been Zarkon, but he's surrounded by lava, and these corpses of the people from his world, of Lance's world, these corpses, these skeletal corpses emerge from the lava, and I thought that for a children's show, this was a very shocking visual. Yeah, that's all I have to say about that, as Forrest Gump would say.
The only other thing I'll interject is back to our early discussion about how being in syndication messes with order.
Uh-huh.
You might find it interesting to know that in my market, which at the time, let's see, 2000, I would have been here in LA. This was episode 26. This was the last episode that aired.
Wow.
Wow.
And I was like, we went out on this? Are you kidding me?
That's amazing. Pretty
That's
amazing.
Funny.
So we're in the final stretch here. We have the last half dozen episodes. The first of these is called Stealth Voltron, written by series head writer Mark Handler. The Black Draco, a dragon from another dimension, steals the lair of Yellow Lion. The Voltron Force goes through a portal to the dragon's dimension and the dragon's world. And when they pass through this portal, the lions become stealth lions.
Well, I do think that this whole series of episodes here was originally inspired by the toys, because I think there was mentioned that Mark Handler had said that this had been the only time that a toy had inspired any of the episodes.
Yes.
That's absolutely correct. Stealth Voltron was introduced because, at this point, because we're into the second set, this is where Trendmasters did start exerting their influence. And had the series gone on to the third set, it would have increased.
Yeah.
I can't confirm that.
Yeah, I will say that in defense of this change, where we have these, you know, every time, and for the rest of the series, as the Lions go through this portal, there's a reason for them to go through a portal in most of the following episodes, you know, by coincidence, and they morph into this stealth incarnation or whatever. I will say, in defense of the toy influence on the show, when you have product on a retail shelf, you have to refresh your SKUs, your product offerings every so often, or your shelf space gets really stale. So if you're at a Walmart and you've got a toy line, if it's there for more than a year, or these days seemingly a few weeks, you've got a stagnant toy line, and you know, retailers are not going to be happy. So I can imagine why the toy company Trendmasters would be motivated to produce new merchandise. And frankly, I my gut thought is that if Voltron Force had made it through a second season, we would have seen some changes visually to those lines in that show as well. For that very reason, for merchandising purposes. So, you know, love it or leave it, as far as Stealth Voltron's concerned, I do understand why it was done. What do you guys think of Stealth Voltron itself?
I wasn't a big fan of him, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Same here.
From a storytelling perspective, I honestly don't think we had the chance to get a long enough sample of what they really wanted to do. It's like, we saw him, we got enough established, here's what this function does, here's things we can do with it. But its long-term storytelling potential, we'll never know, because there weren't that many episodes left. So, be honest, I'm like, interesting, but where would it have gone for another year? I can't tell.
Yeah, I will say that this episode, you could make a drinking game out of the word stealth. they say stealth so many times in this episode, you would be lit by the end. It's kind of funny. Yeah, we're not just stealth lions, we're robot lions, we're stealth lions, and activate stealth servos and all the rest of this when they form Voltron. It's kind of funny. But anyway, I do just wish the robot had bigger feet and a chunkier head. But other than that, it doesn't look too horribly bad. I think the robot needed some visible feet. They looked pretty stubby. But other than that, it's there. Moving on, okay. Gladiators, written by Pamela Hickey and Dennis McCoy. Zarkon sets up a challenge match between Lotor and Lance. The fight is basically a diversion so that Zarkon can power up a special proton cannon. This episode also incidentally features Stealth Voltron. Thoughts on this one?
Where did he get the proton cannon again?
It was in some, I don't recall all the details. I mean, I reviewed these episodes, but it was a few weeks back. It was on some other planet, I think.
Yeah, I was just wondering if that other planet was part of the Danubian Starman.
Well, the thing is, I'm running through my brain, and it's been a while since I've seen the actual episode, but we've done proton cannon before in the original series. I believe that's the giant gun in the two-part Garrett episode is the proton cannon. It's like,
oh, really?
I've heard this name before.
Robotech had that big, enormous gun, too. I forget what they called it, the Grand Cannon. But
yes, that's what it was, at Alaska Base.
Yes.
Right, but I'm just saying this exact turn of phrase, I think, has been in the original show, too. So
I do see here, I'm spinning through some notes that I took, and I don't want to waste people's time by trying to find the exact source of where the weapon came from, but it looks like this weapon would rip open the dimensional fabric and basically be a sledgehammer that would destroy basically the entire universe just by firing it, which makes you wonder why he would want to fire it, because, you know, they kind of live in the universe. But anyway, yeah. That's that whole megalomaniacal, you know, I don't care what you say, I want to do this, so I'm going to do this. Anyway, moving on, The Hunter, written by Scott Guy. The Voltron Force is trapped by this cyborg hunter character called Kolak. The Hunter tries to meld the team together, removing their humanity and turning them into a giant techno-sapient. It also features the return of Dracotron. Thoughts on this one?
Well, I love Dracotron, so I was happy with this. And Scott Guy was the one who originally wrote the Dracotron episode, so you know I was a fan of having a sequel to that. So I like this episode.
Shannon,
I would agree with that. I also do like the adding the hunter aspect to it. The idea that, yes, that we see that the team works together as a team, but they're also very much their individual persons. This is taking the argument of they should then be able to, you know, take their individual selves and turn them into a giant something. They work together great apart. It's also, in a way, the undercurrent of it, I think, is a celebration of their individuality as well as their teammanship at the end of the day. That was one of the senses I got out of it.
Oh, great. I hadn't thought of that. That's a good angle. I just thought that what it looked like they were, Kolak was turning them into, it looked pretty wonky, but that's just a stupid visual observation. So, and anyway, yeah, I did like Kolak. I thought he brought a fun angle to it. It reminded me a little bit of in Firefly, you know, the Joss Whedon short-lived series where, what was that guy called? He came on the ship and very quickly rendered them all, you know, incapacitated. I forget the name of that guy. It's been a while since I've seen that, but it just brings an interesting different angle. You know, it's for once Lotor isn't the chief baddie.
Right.
So moving on, three episodes left. This one is Dominus Goes Home, written by Pamela Hickey and Dennis McCoy. Finally, the Voltron Force is trying to return Dominus home. It turns out Dominus lives in that other dimension that requires the lions to become stealthy. Lotor attacks, and Kolak also appears here. He sort of teams up with Lotor. This is his second and final appearance in the series, and Dominus goes home.
Kind of like we were saying on the other episode, you really got to feel for Dominus. Like I said, not all monsters are bad, so we already have this. Now here's somebody, a being, and it needs something. And so here we are getting to see it recur again, and the idea that that we got far enough into the series where we could bring things back like this was kind of nice. It's just sad that we didn't get much more of that, because that's part of even what was nice about the original show and the original mythos was that we could keep tying things back into each other into a greater piece, even between vehicle and lion, the farther along they got.
Right.
If that makes sense.
No, I agree. I also liked to sort of expand on what you've talked about, not all the monsters are bad. It's kind of fun that, you know, even in the original series when Urak was made a Robeast, Zarkon is made a Robeast, they really don't act like they have any humanity, or Druility or Doomity, whatever you want to call them, when they are in their Robeast forms. They just happen to have originally been, organic life forms. But other than that, they've lost everything. They're just generic Robeasts once they're in there. But in this one, you know, in this series, you have Alfor put into a Robeast. You have Dominus made into a giant beast. And you have examples of these monsters not just being monsters, you know, as beyond just Dominus. And I think that's an interesting angle to this show. Okay, final two episodes. This one is Consider the Alternatives, written by Mark Hoffmeyer. I believe that's his only writing credit in the series. The Voltron Force basically travels into a parallel universe and encounters misfit versions of the Voltron Force pilots, as well as Lotor and seemingly Hagar. The episode comes to a head when Stealth Voltron, because again, our heroes have to turn into Stealth Voltron as they pass into this other world. They have a brief fight with the original version of Voltron from this parallel world. So you have Stealth Voltron and its energy sword versus a false color original Voltron with its blazing sword, and that's one of the highlights. Thoughts on this one?
I like the premise of this. I like alternate Voltrons, you know, and the parallel universe thing. That's always worked for me before, and then the fact that the real Voltron Force has to help this band of misfits. It's sort of like there was a recent cartoon that was put out, Bizarro League versus Justice League.
Okay.
And the Bizarro League was this weird band of misfits who weren't really bad guys, but Bizarro isn't really a bad guy, but they became bad in what they were doing, and the Justice League had to work together with them to stop... what was it, Brainiac? I forget. Yeah. Anyway, I see this type of thing again, and I like it.
Yeah. Thoughts on this one, Shannon?
Well, I had alluded to it a lot earlier that it was really the one thing that, I like the storyline too, but in hindsight, it's also opened my mind as to all the different chronologies existing, and you know, since they all come from a canon location versus, say, fan fiction, which is WEP-approved TV series, mm-hmm. The idea that, okay, if we're seeing this alternate Voltron Force, then alternate timelines must also be possible. And it's,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm just making it, I just thought I'd just bring that up one more time. And it's just like, that means it takes that idea that all stories are true. And maybe even, you know, those of us fans, you know, older, even ones that have come to it newer, you know, the stories that, you know, mean something to us and what we see have just as much value. So in a way, sure. It was kind of a nice respect to that.
And you know, the original series opening narration talks about, you know, from days of long ago, from uncharted regions of the universe comes a legend. Maybe what we are watching, even though, you know, they talk about in the narration, Voltron has come back. It's not just from legend. Maybe we're watching different stories about the legend of Voltron ourselves. And maybe there's a meta legend going on here. And we're as we watch Defender of the Universe in the third dimension and Voltron Force, maybe we're experiencing legendary, you know, different tales about the legends of these pilots. That's kind of fun.
I love that thought. It's good. Yeah,
So, final episode, another clip show, unfortunately. It's called Biography, The Voltron Force. Now, I will say that as I put together this sequence that we've been walking through, I put this at the very end only because Amalgamus is definitely not anti-Voltron in this episode. It's very clear that he's actually sticking up for them as the... basically the premise of this episode is that it's a documentary about the Voltron pilots, and whenever the host, a name that the guy, I love this character, Weep Weep Cherimoya, he's one of my favorite incidental characters on this show. Anytime he questions the Lions or anything that's happened, Amalgamus, he's kind of embarrassed at times, but he comes to the defense of the pilots. So that's the only reason I threw this at the end. Again, this is another episode where it could really kind of take place almost anywhere after Amalgamus is restored. So anyway, that's the premise of the episode.
Well, this was actually in the 26th slot for most of the places that were reporting on this, right?
Right, that's true. That's another point.
Okay.
Good point.
So it's sort of like a best of all in one kind of thing. And it, you know, brings together a lot of things that happened during the show. I think I've seen other things like this. I don't remember if maybe the Brady Bunch or something like that. I can't remember, but other shows have used this as their final show. So, it kind of works for me. I don't have a problem with it ending that way. You know, I can see what had happened after the 26 episodes, because I think what originally was written was that Ted Koppler had ordered 26 episodes.
Oh, okay.
Right.
That's what I think had happened. I don't know if there was any plans to go beyond this, you know, even if it was successful.
I know that what little I can tell you is I know that it had been discussed at least at some point, because... Mike Young and I said, I kept up with him after I did the interview, and there was at least talk in his offices of seeing if they could get more, because he'd hinted to me at least a direction they wanted to go. And I don't know if I can even this many years later talk about it, but he did say, if this gets approved, I will give you an opportunity to pitch, but that never happened. So, and that's kind of one of those, so close and yet so far.
Well, can you at least touch on whether or not they would have introduced Voltrex? This is a toy that Trendmasters had released.
Okay, I couldn't remember if that had been disclosed. Yes, that was the thing. That was what our conversations were about before that had become public.
What's very interesting is that Voltrex, at least I have a Toy Fair retailer catalog from Trendmasters, and in the photos of Voltrex, it looks like, and this was an actually released toy, unlike Dracotron, which never was released, but Voltrex seems to have been comprised of six dinosaurs, the five traditionally colored dinos that match up with the Lions we know and love, but also looks like a silver or a white one as well. I don't know how that factors in. Do you have any insight into that?
No, I was never taken that far into it, but I knew the name. I knew the name, and I knew that, and that's why I was hinting later when we talked about Stealth Voltron, about knowing Trendmaster had an influence, because that's where basically Trendmaster had already made the toy, and so they were going to have to write around the toy, and that's really all that I could tell you that I ever knew.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well, this looks like a good segue into the toy section here.
Sorry that I, at this point, really do have to jump off. I'm going to tune into the whole thing and listen to you guys talk more about the toys. It gives me something to look forward to as well.
Okay.
I have enjoyed getting to spend all this time with you.
Shannon, it has been a treat to speak with you. Thank you so much. And I hope we keep in touch in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Shannon. That was awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for continuing to support Voltron. It's great to be, you know, all of you together this many years later.
We know someday Voltron will come back.
Voltron is needed once more. Thank you again, Shannon.
Yes, Voltron will be needed once more.
All right. And on that note, take care, guys.
You too.
Bye for now.
All right. Thank you, Shannon. At this point, that was a good segue into talking about the toy line that was developed by Trendmasters.
Okay.
So, as many of us are aware, Trendmasters had done a line of toys that was supporting this show. And as we know, we didn't get that with Voltron Force. But having a toy line to be able to support the show actually really helps, you know, to get the viewership there. It helps to get the name out. You know, if people are walking through stores and they go through the toy lines of stores, whether it's a Target or back then it was KB Toys, it was Toys R Us, Kitty City might have still been around, I'm not sure. But they're, you know, if you're walking through stores and you see toys and you see Voltron's name out there, then obviously it's helping your brand.
Yes.
So in any case, I have to say the Trendmasters helped in that respect.
I would agree.
But there may be things about the quality of the toys that you may want to talk about as well.
Yeah, but I will say first and foremost, when I saw Voltron toys again at Toys R Us and at KB Toys, as you mentioned, it was a thrill. I was absolutely, it was just a jaw-dropping experience seeing Voltron. You know, Voltron is back again at retail shelves. I have a very fond memory in the 80s of seeing the Defender of the Universe toys occupying an entire aisle at a Kmart store one time, both sides of the aisle. It was incredible. And in the 90s, seeing Voltron again on retail shelves, Toys R Us, KB and various other outlets, that was really a cool thing. So the fact that we had merchandise, and I cannot state enough how much I wish they had, that Voltron Force had found its way to our local Walmarts and Toys R Us stores and all that good stuff. Before jumping into the toys, there was a series of video cassettes that were actually released for Voltron the Third Dimension. Trimark Home Video released, I don't know how many episodes, but at least the first several episodes. So if you are a diehard Voltron collector and VHS still does something for you, then those are available.
I think anyway, you might even be able to still buy those either on eBay or on Amazon.
Oh, I'm sure. I only have one or two of them myself, and each of them has two episodes on it. Yeah, you can probably get them dirt cheap only because video cassettes aren't exactly popular these days.
Right.
So anyway, jumping into the toys were largely action figure focused. They remind me a bit in retrospect of the Panache Place toys, which, as you know, Mark, I'm quite fond of.
Yes, you are.
Yes, indeed. The actual number of action figures released for this line actually exceeds the number of figures that Panache Place had released. Panache released 12 figures in its 1985 wave. And looking through here, I can see that 13 action figures were released for this line, so they beat them by one. There were two versions of each of the pilots. Keith Lance, Pidge, Allura, and Hunk were released as in with the Voltron Lion Force marking, where these are all plastic, molded in color, no chrome kind of stuff. They had spring-loaded weapons and removable helmets. So you had those. There were also stealth Voltron Force versions of each of these. They had different armor. They had that vac metalized chrome on them and other weapons and whatnot. And then for the villains, you had only three. You had King Zarkon, Prince Lotor, and Hagar the Witch. Now, none of these characters looked exactly like what you would see in the series.
Right.
So if you're looking for a definitive Keith or Princess Allura, you're not going to find one in this toy line. But I think that arguably the stealth versions are a little closer to the TV show, because in the TV show, regardless of whether they were flying the original Lions or the stealth Lions, they wore the same flight suits. The toys had differently styled suits that the stealth versions with their chrome arguably look more like the TV show characters. Hagar the Witch in particular is pretty interesting because she actually is reminiscent of the old Masters of the Universe Man-E Faces figure, where you have this knob on the top of the character's head and it turns his face from human to robot to monster. In this case, Hagar is actually dressed as she was when she was young and beautiful and hot, if you want to call her that, in her past from the Voltron, the third dimension. But she has this little little lever that swaps her face from being young and beautiful to this hideous older face. It still doesn't look exactly like what she had in the series when she was the witch, but still it's a neat feature for that character. And unlike the other characters, she actually, instead of coming with spring-loaded weapons and swords and all that, she actually comes with a robe-beast cat-like creature, which evokes Koba from the 80s show. That's kind of cool.
Right, right.
So, yeah, so beyond the figures, the 13 figures, there were vehicles. So the stealth figures were repackaged with what they called stealth cycles. There was a set of 5 cycles individually sold. There was one for each of the lions, a black stealth cycle with Keith, red with Lance, etc. And I have never owned these myself. I never found them particularly interesting because the cycles were never in the show. But they did have...
It's like the Spider-Man cycle.
Yeah,
you know?
or
Spider-Man needed a cycle.
Yeah, or Superman, like in the 80s superpower toy line where Superman has this spaceship. I mean, this guy's faster than a speeding bullet. What does he need a spaceship for? But I guess it protects him from kryptonite.
Some toy executive somewhere liked cycles really bad and decided everybody should be on a cycle.
Yeah, or when Kenner, back when the real Ghostbusters toys were released and later when they did the Batman toys, you know, let's have Peter Venkman in, you know, this outfit or that outfit, and just stuff they never had in the actual cartoon. But in any case, the fun gimmick about these cycles, if you're just thinking purely from a toy perspective, the fun gimmick is that these sleek looking stealth cycles sort of transform into lions. They actually have legs on their fenders that they look just like the old Matchbox lion legs from the deluxe Voltron toy. They extend down, and once you've done that, wow, this bike is now a bike with lion legs. So, they could shoot a spring-loaded missile, and they're kind of cool from a toy perspective, but again, they look like nothing from the actual show.
Okay.
Yeah, so moving on to the figures, there were two other toys released to go with the figures, and these are both legendary and a bit notorious. There was a toy called Voltron Mighty Lion Vehicles. This is both one of my favorite and most detested Voltron collectibles ever. It is, I love it and hate it at the same time. It is a 20-inch tall representation of the 80s era Voltron, and in that sense, it is awesome. It actually holds the third dimension pilot action figures. And it will, I have verified, it will also hold the Matty Collector figures that were released later.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's really cool. You can't quite stuff the Panache Place people in there because their legs are fully extended, and there are some fit issues there. But it is an amazing toy. It is visually impressive, very large when assembled. Each lion has light-up eyes, which is really cool. You know, recently Toynami released a 30th anniversary edition of their Masterpiece mold, and one of the big selling points was the light-up eyes of the toy. And this toy had light-up eyes in all 5 lions. And when Black Lion's eyes were lit, so too were the Voltron robot eyes. It was really, really slick. Each lion has a missile launcher. Some of them had 3 missiles. Some had 1. Black, blue, and yellow lion had these little compartments in their bellies, and they could drop little bombs when you moved a little lever. Very cool feature. The robot had an enormous blazing sword and a what the toys called a star-crossed shield. It's basically that spinning laser blade that we've seen in all the many other Voltron toys. Very, very cool toy. I cannot stress how awesome it is visually. Now let's talk the cons. The cons of this toy are also significant. Trendmasters is known to have had quality issues with its toys. I had already talked about the chrome plating on the stealth action figures. The chrome plating on all Voltron toys made by Trendmasters is known to flake off very easily.
Mark Oliver had talked about that in our episode with Mark Oliver.
Yeah.
We had asked him which toys out of all the Voltron toys that have ever been made deteriorated the most. And he said the Trendmasters in their boxes, he kept a mint in box, and you could still see them flaking off.
Oh, yes. I have seen... examples of Voltrex, which we touched on. I mean, not in person, but online, where in the sealed boxes, the chrome is almost gone, leaving this really horrid off-white color for the underlying toy. It's really kind of sad.
Yeah, you would have thought you would have seen primer underneath.
Yeah, maybe. Or
I was looking for primer gray.
That would be nice, yeah. But but anyway, the the gray lion, like Hunk's lion.
Yeah, too. There you go.
But the that's not all. It's not just the chrome. Some of the plastic is insanely fragile, especially with this toy that I'm talking about, the Mighty Lion Vehicles toy. Black Lion, in particular, is known to shatter in box when it's shipped. It does not always happen, but it can. And when it does, it is a very ugly sight. I have seen people reviewing this toy online and then finding out just afterward that the lion had, that Voltron had taken a dive, a very minor dive, and something shatters. One of the rear legs or the front leg or the head or the hatch that lets you put the figure inside. This toy is very difficult to find anyway, and it's even more difficult to find intact and complete. So I love the look of the toy. If it were sturdier, it would be my favorite Voltron toy, period, bar none. But because [S2] Wow. [S1] Of its quality issues, it is lacking. So
okay.
That's it for that toy. The other toy is the Stealth Lion counterpart, which is it's called Stealth Voltron Mighty Lion Vehicles. It's also 20 inches tall. It will hold the various action figures. I do not own this and never have. I've been toying with buying it for quite some time, but I've heard that it has similar quality issues. So that's it for the action figures. Moving on to other items, I should point out that an item that technically isn't third dimension that Trendmaster sold was a re-release of the die-cast metal Voltron that Matchbox had released in the 80s. So it's got the die-cast parts. It actually includes some of the weapons that the Popey Go Lion toy had also included. You can distinguish this toy from the 80s releases because the shading of some of the lions is a little different than it was in the 80s. Red and green lions have these weird flaps on their hindquarters, like this almost like an aileron sort of thing sticking out, which is kind of weird.
Do you think they use the same mold?
Yes. But somehow they modified some of the stuff. And so the red and green lions have these weird, like a tab almost, that sticks up at the spine near the tail area. It's really weird. But the plastic quality, again, here is not up to snuff compared to the Matchbox stuff. The chrome is known to flake really badly, but it looks nice, especially in a box. So there's that. So going back to the third dimension items, one of my favorites is actually the Blazing Sword. There's a role-playing toy of the Blazing Sword. It sort of evokes memories of LJN's Blazing Sword toy that they sold. But this one actually has lights and sounds, and it collapses. So you almost like one of those totes umbrellas. You can push it together, and when you hit a little button, it will telescope out and then flash. It's really a pretty neat piece. The hilt of the sword is chrome-plated, so I imagine it has the same chrome issues that the other toys do, but my particular example is still looks nice. So moving on, we're done with the figures and the role-playing stuff. There are different toys of Voltron, such as Galaxy Guard Voltron and Galaxy Guard Stealth Voltron. They were basically 5 or 6 inch tall little Voltrons that didn't transform, but they had a little spring-loaded weapon and a sword and a shield, and you could put a teeny tiny little figure of Keith inside of the chest of the robot. They look really nice on a desk. I think they're pretty neat little representations of the two Voltrons, classic style.
Were they a choking hazard?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm looking at my classic style Galaxy Guard here on a shelf near me, and I don't think it has anything small that that would be any worse than, say, the miniature Voltron 3 from the 80s that Matchbox sold. The figure, actually, the figurine of Keith probably would be a choking hazard.
Yes, that's what I was referring to.
Okay, yeah, that little guy is quite small, and he's actually two pieces because he's articulated at the hips. If a leg were to break off, that would, I don't know if it'd be a choking hazard, but it would definitely be something that could be swallowed. It's probably too small to choke on unless you were very young. But it is very small. Moving on from the Galaxy Guard ones, there was again the 80s style Voltron and the Stealth Voltron. There was a toy called Cyber Sentinel Voltron, which looked very much like the old Matchbox Deluxe Voltron, but it could not separate or transform. Its gimmick was that it had a motion sensor, and if something tripped the sensor, then it would actually move and had lights and sounds and all that. So it was kind of a neat little gimmick. I actually got one. I have a loose example that I've not tried out. It didn't interest me when it was originally at retail, but owning one now by happenstance, it's actually a pretty neat little item.
Okay.
Jumping from that, there was also a toy that they simply called Lion Force Voltron, and this one is actually very interesting. It's all plastic. It looks as if it were taken directly from the molds for the Popey Bandai middle-sized Go Lion toy that was sold only in Japan. It was a toy that Matchbox never imported. It was sort of halfway between the miniature and deluxe robots. It actually does transform and separate. This one is all plastic, and it has the same. It has a few visual changes from the original mold, but it's actually a very nice piece. It's a little larger than the LJN motorized Voltron, which is also a cool little find. Moving on from that, there was a toy called simply Mighty Lion Force. I mean, the names of these products is quite confusing. They all sound so similar, but they're very different toys.
I'm just saying the names don't really correspond with anything in the show either.
They don't.
I mean, it's just the only things that do are Stealth Voltron and the regular Voltron and the names of the pilots and everything like that. There's really nothing that corresponds with the show.
Right. I mean, these toys are all visual. I mean, they're certainly visually inspired by the show, but certainly a name like Galaxy Guard or Cyber Sentinel doesn't. That stuff never gets used in the show. So, yeah, completely agree. Mighty Lion Force is actually an 11-inch version of Voltron, all plastic. It actually looks a lot like, again, the Matchbox 11-inch Deluxe Voltron 3 and the Trendmasters re-release of that mold. But this one has wheels on the bottoms of the red, green, blue, and yellow lions. There's a pullback friction motor in blue and yellow. And each lion holds a teeny tiny little figure that is the same scale as the little Keith figure that goes in those Galaxy Guard toys. So the lions also shoot the red and green lions shoot the heads. Black, yellow, and blue have missile launchers, and they're the long missiles that you see in the 90s era toys. So they're not the dinky things that wreaked havoc on kids in the 70s with Battlestar Galactica. They're the larger missiles. But yes, the pilots possibly are choking hazards. There is also a stealth version of this. It's about 11 inches tall, a completely new mold, of course. This one, curiously, does not include any pilot figures. So it has no pilot, no little pilots, but it has its own weapons. And so these lions from both the classic style and stealth version, you could buy them in box sets or you could buy them individually. So you could get black by itself, blue and yellow by themselves, and then red and green bundled together in a two-pack for each of those. So there was that. Just about at the end here, there was Voltrex, which the three of us, you know, you, I, and Shannon had talked about briefly. Six robotic dinosaurs that could form a unique robot, and seemingly that might have made an appearance or been featured prominently in a Voltron Third Dimension episode that was never made. Who knows? But It's neat that they, you know, upped the ante and changed things around again. I can't say that I really like the visual designs, but, you know, kudos to Trendmasters for trying.
Well, from a collector's standpoint, all right, if you had the Voltrex, would it be worth more based on the fact that it was never part of the show but might have been part of the show?
I don't know. I think it is such a niche item because, you know, the Third Dimension itself is not especially, you know, it's not as fondly remembered as the 80s show. And so it in itself is kind of a niche interest. So you could say, okay, maybe because it was never in the show, it has a unique appeal. But also the flip side is it was never in the show, so why do I care? You know what I mean? It was seemingly made in lower quantities, so that may make it a little bit rarer. But I don't know that it's especially more valuable. Good question.
Okay.
So the last item is an unproduced item, and that is Dracotron. I have seen photos I have a Toy Fair catalog, as I mentioned earlier, that shows photos of it. I've seen online images of two prototypes of this toy, but it was never released at retail. And frankly, this is something I would love to have seen. It was the five dragons from the Third Dimension episodes, and they, including the the really large and visually impressive Black Draco. They could form an 11-inch or so tall robot, and wow, what a toy it would have been. It does still seem to suffer from the same plastic quality and chrome adhesion issues that the other toys had in this line, but it sure looks cool.
Yeah. I would have loved to have seen that one.
Yeah, that would have been a nice display. I mean, especially because no toy company has ever really made a large Robeast to fight Voltron. Panache Place had its, you know, it's the little action figure-sized Robeasts of Scorpius and Mutalor. They planned to release large Robeasts that would transform from coffins, but that never happened. And then the little Hagar figure from the third dimension had this little Robeast cat. But, you know, none of these Voltron toys have ever had an appropriately sized Robeast to fight. And so it would have been cool to have an 11-inch or 12-inch Dracotron. That would have been cool.
Yeah, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, and that pretty much does it for Voltron toys.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, so we've pretty much come to, you know, we talked about the episodes, we talked about the toys, we talked about the behind-the-scenes stuff. We've pretty much covered a lot of this, and I want to thank you for spending that time, Greg, with me. And I want to thank Shannon for spending that time with me, because we got a lot of good insight from you guys from this show that a lot of people, you know, have mixed feelings about it.
Yeah.
You know, they really, you know, like the fact, well, I like the fact that, you know, Voltron was one of the early shows that tried doing CGI animation. And that's a big risk. I mean, you know, if you're going to get into CGI animation as one of the early pioneers, you got to expect that it's not going to be the same quality as some of those shows that go 5 years from now, you know?
Right.
It's going to be something that the quality is not going to be as good as later versions of things.
Right.
So you had to, you know, swallow that first, that okay, it doesn't look as good because it wasn't that good 2D feeling, but it was 3D, and they couldn't incorporate as many, you know, visual aspects that they could in 2D animation.
Right.
So once you got past that, then how was the story? Oh, the story was great. All right, there were a lot of different things that were happening in that story that told us a lot of backstories about a lot of the characters. We went into more of the mythology of Voltron and all the different characters like King Alphor and King Zarkon, Prince Lotor, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, you started developing some different types of Voltrons. Like, who would have ever thought of destroying the Voltron lions?
Yeah.
And then having their souls come back in a different form than before.
Right.
You know, and developing that stealth Voltron idea and stuff like that. So I go back to this and I think, yeah, these were some good storylines. We still had some of the original voice actors, which was cool.
Right.
And I really enjoyed watching these episodes. Obviously, there were a couple episodes that weren't as good as the others, but you're going to get that in 26 episodes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you and I discussed, you know, recording this conversation, you know, some months back, I binge watched The Third Dimension, and I it turns out I had seen maybe 2/3 of the episodes when they first aired. I there's one, the episode where, you know, Keith holds Lance at gunpoint is one that I had never seen earlier and originally, and then many of the later ones I hadn't seen. But in getting acquainted and reacquainted with these episodes, I really came to appreciate, you know, that they brought a lot of new and interesting things to the table. I mean, it is not for everyone. You do have to put your mind back into the 90s when this was very cutting edge stuff. And so, yeah, I mean, let's watch, I mean, with an objective eye, let's watch Beast Wars today. Look at its animation compared to, say, Transformers Prime. There's been a right. huge evolution. And, you know, that stuff looks, in a lot of ways, just as so-called cheesy or bad as what you see here in V3D. And I would say that one thing that Voltron the Third Dimension, in addition to motion capture, one thing that they did that was a bit cutting edge was they attempted to show real human beings. And I don't mean they're trying to make them look just like real people that you'd see walking down the street, but you know, in Reboot, you had humanoid characters that were colored blue and green, and it sort of subtly lets you forgive the fact that they don't look like real people. You know, when you see them, they're blue, they're green, they're purple, whatever. Beast Wars had no humans in it at all. This was one of the very first shows that tried to show people. And so do they look a bit bizarre by our standards today, you know, compared to, you know, the CGI that we see today? Yes. But I think that they attempted a great deal. They were very, you know, maybe bit off more than they can chew in some areas, but I think the show, when you look at it and you check your preconceptions at the door and just watch it as a story, it's fun. And that's, at the end of the day, is it fun? Do you enjoy it? I had fun. I enjoyed it. And I think that if Voltron fans give the show another shot, they would probably enjoy it too.
And the other thing is did it take me on a ride? As a Voltron fan, did I feel like I was taken for a ride? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there were times where I was talking to the TV.
Yeah.
You know, like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, really?
And I gotta tell you, when there were some action scenes in particular where those lions are zipping around, and I literally was smiling at my computer watching these shows, thinking, now that is fun action right there. You know, I mean, and yes, there are some story points where you think, what the heck just happened, you know, for good or for ill, but... It is a ride, and I had great fun watching this and getting reacquainted with it.
Right. So, as I said before, I want to go through the Voltron credits. Just like the end of every episode, I want to give kudos to those people that made this show, the Voltron, the Third Dimension that we remember.
Okay.
All right, so I want to... go through, and the first thing that you see in Voltron credits is the executive producers. The executive producers of Voltron the Third Dimension were Ted Koppler, Kevin Harlan, Mike Young, and John Copeland. The producer was Bill Schultz. Associate producers were Mara Sullivan and Susan Norkin. Executive story editor, Mark Handler. The writers were Sean Catherine Derrick, Pamela Hickey and Dennis McCoy, Kelly Ward, Mark Young, Scott Guy, and as we recall, the one episode was Mark Hoffmeyer. The director was Michael Swanigan. The supervising animators were Josh Prickrell and Jeff Montre. Storyboards were Rick Hoberg, Kirk Van Warner, Adrian Gonzalez, Keith Tucker, Dennis Cowan, Kurt Connor, Romed Francisco, Michael Swanigan, and Bill Dubay. The voice director was Kelly Ward. The cast included as the voice of Lance and Coran, Michael Bell, as the voice of Keith and Amalgamus, Neil Ross, as the voice of Allura and Hagar, B.J. Ward, as the voice of Zarkon and Hunk, Kevin Michael Richardson, and as the voice of Lotor and King Alfor, Tim Curry, as the voice of Pidge and Queequeg, that was Billy West, and we had already said Tress MacNeille did the voice of Lafitte.
And Ariella, sorry. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that includes our Voltron credits. That includes our look back at Voltron the Third Dimension on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. We thank you for joining us, and Greg, is there anything you wanted to say?
Let's Voltron the Third Dimension.
All right. Well, we'll see you next time on
Let's Voltron.